From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ukraine crisis. Frustration and anger in northern Nigeria over kidnapped girls. Red Cross describing deteriorating situation in South Sudan. Plus spike and MERS raising some concerns. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Russia is stoking instability in Ukraine, and the Obama administration will impose additional sanctions against Moscow if it does not keep promises made last week to help de-escalate the crisis. But as VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports, Russian officials say they have nothing to do with the violence and believe sanctions will have no impact on the situation in Ukraine.
Secretary Kerry says the world has rightly judged that authorities in Kiev are working in good faith to de-escalate the crisis, while Moscow has put its faith in distraction, deception, and destabilization.
In plain sight, Russia continues to fund, coordinate, and fuel a heavily armed separatist movement in Donetsk. Meanwhile, Russian leaders are making increasingly outrageous claims to justify their action.
The head of Russia's lower house of parliament, Alexei Pushkov, says Russia has never and will never interfere directly in Ukrainian affairs. Pushkov told a news conference in Moscow that the European Union, the United States, and former Ukrainian opposition parties should be held responsible for the current chaos. Fighting between Ukrainian security forces and pro-Russian militants in eastern Ukraine has left at least five militants dead, with Russian President Vladimir Putin calling it a crime and threatening consequences. Ukraine's Interior Ministry said Thursday that its forces, together with army units, had killed five pro-Russia militants and destroyed three of their checkpoints in the eastern city of Slovyansk. In an interview with VOA, Ukraine's ambassador to the United Nations, Yuri Sergeyev, says it's time for tougher sanctions against Russia for its interference in Ukraine.
Naturally, we expect that the reaction of the democratic world will be sounded and the action could be done, including the serious economic sanctions, including the political sanctions.
Speaking to reporters at the State Department, Secretary Kerry said if Russia continues to destabilize Ukraine, it will not just be a grave mistake, it will be an expensive mistake.
President Putin and Russia face a choice. If Russia chooses the path of de-escalation, the international community, all of us, will welcome it. If Russia does not, the world will make sure that the costs for Russia will only grow.
But Duma Chief Pushkov says sanctions are a mistake. He says sanctions will bring huge losses not only to Russia, but also to European countries that have close economic and trade cooperation with Russia. What's more, he says, sanctions cannot help resolve the crisis in Ukraine. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
And in eastern Ukraine, tensions have increased as Ukrainian forces attack pro-Russian insurgents in the city of Slovyansk. VOA's Bryden Padden has our report.
Ukrainian forces clashed with militants in the separatist-held city of Slovyansk on Thursday, days after acting president Oleksandr Turchynov ordered the resumption of military operations in eastern Ukraine. Interior Ministry advisor Stanislav Rachinsky confirms that five Ukrainian insurgents were killed in the attack.
The last information concerning the shooting in Slovyansk is that anti-terrorist forces have destroyed three checkpoints of separatists. Five terrorists were killed. From our side, there is one casualty. We still don't know exactly whether he is killed or injured. The operation continues.
Ukraine also increased its military presence outside the city of Donetsk, setting up a roadblock outside the city. A few kilometers away, pro-Russian protesters manned their own roadblock. In the city of Makivka, a pro-Russian group dismantled the barricades it had built in front of City Hall. The group maintains a presence in the building but has allowed local officials back in. One member, Sergei Novikovsky, says the occupation of the building was meant as a peaceful protest.
We took it down ourselves because, anyway, barricades will never save us. And moreover, we are unarmed. We are peaceful citizens, and we are protesting peacefully the violent activity of the Ukrainian government.
In the city of Gorlivka, armed militia behind makeshift barricades maintain control of the police station. The group spokesman declined VOA's request for an interview, saying they see no benefit in talking to the media at this time. In the city of Mariupol, Ukrainian forces reported no casualties after clearing the city hall of pro-Russian protesters who had occupied it for more than a week. Russia also announced it is starting military drills near the Ukrainian border, raising concerns of direct military confrontation between the two countries. Brian Patton, VOA News, Donetsk.
Ukraine's foreign minister Andriy Deshchetsy on Thursday blasted the Russian decision to start military maneuvers.
Yeah, we are very much concerned with the Russian decision to start this military exercise even closer to the Ukrainian border than it was planned earlier. And it very much escalates situation in this region.
And he said his country will fight any invading troops.
We will now fight with Russian troops if needed, if they will invade Ukraine, to protect our territory.
Speaking to the Associated Press in Prague, Deshchetsy said his country has been taught a lesson by Russia's annexation of Crimea. He said the new Russian military exercises are taking place even closer to the Ukrainian border than it had earlier been planned, and demanded the withdrawal of Russian troops. With the crisis continuing to deepen in Ukraine, concern is growing in neighboring Turkey about the economic fallout. But as Dorian Jones reports now from Istanbul, Ankara also sees opportunities.
Rising tensions between Ukraine and Russia are putting regional neighbor Turkey in an increasingly difficult position, having close political and economic ties with its Western allies and Moscow. A visiting scholar of the Brussels-based Carnegie Europe Institute, Sinan Ülgen, says there are significant risks to Turkey.
The political economic risks are increasing because the more the West hardens its position against Russia, the more it talks about introducing sanctions, the more difficult it will be for Turkey to keep a balanced act between Russia and the West.
Even though Ankara criticized Moscow's annexation of Crimea, it has not followed its Western allies and imposed economic sanctions on Russia, which is Turkey's sixth largest export market. In a move seen as a goodwill gesture by Ankara to Moscow, the Turkish national air carrier, Turkish Airlines, announced a resumption of flights to Crimea. While observers say Ankara has tried to stay on the sidelines, Finansbank chief economist İnan Demir warns Turkey will not be able to escape the financial fallout from the crisis.
If we see the tensions escalating further, then perhaps investors will be taking another look, and that won't be in emerging markets' favor either. So even though there is some scope for capital outflows from Russia finding their way to Turkey, I think the broader emerging market sentiment will be weaker, and that would have an indirect effect on Turkey as well.
With Russia providing half of Turkey's natural gas needs, much of which comes from a pipeline running through Ukraine, analysts warn the Turkish economy is vulnerable to disruption. Energy also represents a potential for powerful leverage by Moscow against Ankara, like the rest of Europe, according to political consultant Attila Yeşilada of the Istanbul-based Global Source Partners. But Yeşilada says the Ukraine crisis could eventually be to Ankara's advantage.
One way to effectively discipline Russia is to create an alternative to Gazprom's monopoly on most of European natural gas services. And that could be to accelerate the building of the Iraqi-Kurdish pipeline to Turkey, and then eventually persuade Ankara to help peace in Cyprus and to reconcile with Israel so undersea pipelines can be built to Turkey.
Cyprus and Israel have recently discovered large natural gas reserves. And analysts say that could help Europe diversify its gas supply and lessen dependence on Russia. But aware of Europe's talk of diversification, Gazprom is seeking to shore up its relations with Turkey, its second largest customer after Germany. This week, Gazprom deputy head Alexander Medvedev held talks with the Turkish energy minister Taner Yildiz to expand cooperation between the countries. While the deepening crisis in Ukraine poses economic risks to Turkey in the short term, analysts predict ultimately the crisis could be a catalyst leading to Ankara achieving a key strategic goal of establishing itself as a regional energy hub. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
All that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Syrian government airstrikes killed at least 27 people, injured many others at a market near the northern city of Aleppo. Activist groups, including the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, says government jets hit the crowded market in the town of Atareb, located in Aleppo province. The strikes are the latest in the Syrian government's bombing campaign against rebel-held areas in Aleppo that began back in December. Meantime, in Damascus, the United Nations was allowed to resume food distribution inside the besieged Yarmouk camp after being blocked for 15 days. A spike in the cases of the deadly Middle East respiratory syndrome in Saudi Arabia has alarmed international health officials, but regionally, authorities are offering few preventative measures for the MERS virus. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more from Cairo.
Saudi Arabia announced two more MERS-related deaths and two new infections Thursday, one day after the World Health Organization renewed concerns about the dramatic jump in the number of victims in recent days. Health ministries from Saudi Arabia to Egypt have tried to downplay the threat of Middle East respiratory syndrome. The coronavirus, which proves fatal to about one-third of its victims, first appeared in Saudi Arabia 2 years ago. Saudi officials report nearly 300 people have come down with the disease's pneumonia-like symptoms since then. More than 50 of those cases have been reported in the past week. Regional authorities say there is no cause for alarm or need to impose preventative measures such as travel restrictions. Dr. Amr Kandil, chief of Egypt's health ministry's preventative sector, says his agency has set up screening sites across the country to check suspected cases.
The total sample examined from human cases, it is about 8,500 cases, and all of these samples were negative to the MERS corona.
But Kandil said the probability for a MERS outbreak remains, given frequent travel by Egyptians to Saudi Arabia's religious sites and workers throughout the region. He also notes the virus is present in some Egyptian camels. The disease, believed to have crossed over to humans from camels, first appeared only to be passed through close contact with the animals. But recently, health workers treating people with MERS have themselves fallen ill. Cases tied to human-to-human contact have also spread to other parts of the Gulf and as far afield as Europe and Malaysia, raising concerns the virus may be either reaching a tipping point or mutating. Part of the lack of urgency on prevention may be tied to virus fatigue, scares tied to other viruses, including avian flu, which did not live up to the warnings they could mutate into more transmissible form. Much remains unknown about Middle East respiratory syndrome. Earlier this week, Saudi Health Minister Abdullah bin Abdulaziz Al Rabia conceded as much, even while arguing against the need for aggressive preventative measures.
Hopefully that we will reach to an idea why the surge is in April and May. Could it be that this season is the best for the virus? We don't know. We have no idea.
The next day, the minister was replaced. No reason was given, but with Saudi Arabia expecting millions of visitors in the coming months, during Ramadan in July and the Hajj in October, it's a possible sign the threat is being taken more seriously. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
It's been many days since some 230 teenage girls were kidnapped from their schoolhouse in Nigeria's troubled northeast. Female leaders blame the central government for failing to rescue the girls. We get more now from Heather Murdoch in Abuja.
More than a week after the girls were kidnapped, authorities say at least 190 are still missing. The dozens that are free escaped on their own, fleeing to safety through the bush. The girls that remain captive are believed to be deep within the Sambisa forest, where Boko Haram Islamist militants are known to hide out. Locals say they know roughly where the girls are, but they don't know how to stay alive long enough in the forest to rescue them. While no one has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping, it's widely believed that Boko Haram is holding the girls as spies, servants, or sex slaves. Dressed in black to show solidarity with grieving families, Aishatu Ngolde, a northern human rights activist, says the federal government's failure to locate the girls is tantamount to complicity in the crime.
Are you telling me that Borno State is so thick that no plane can see the ground? Why is there not been there in Borno over our children? They have been taken. We are all mothers. Even this judge's daughter that has been stolen today with the country to live, she would not.
Officials say security forces are using all means at their disposal to rescue the girls. Jan Saint-Pierre, the CEO of Berlin-based security consulting firm Mosicon, says if the Nigerian military launched a direct assault in the forest to rescue the girls, they might kill more girls than they save.
The forests there are really dense. Geography and all the elements there are really hard to really prepare proper operation the way Nigerian army wants to conduct it. And so a full-scale attack that would make them look good and also show strength is simply not feasible. You would end up with many, many more casualties and civilian casualties than you would actually get Boko Haram fighters.
The Nigerian military has been silent in recent days after retracting an initial report that most of the girls had been freed. Saint-Pierre says a rescue would go a long way to improve the image of Nigerian security forces, but it would require negotiations accompanied by precision operations.
For the girls right now, it's finding the proper back channels that would allow for negotiations and that would allow the girls to be freed. They would then save face.
Nigeria has been mired in the Boko Haram insurgency for almost 5 years now, and three northeastern states have been under emergency rule for almost a year. Boko Haram has been blamed for thousands of deaths in attacks on churches, mosques, schools, marketplaces, the government, and most recently, a bus station bombing in the capital that killed 75 people. And things are getting worse, with rights groups saying 1,500 people were killed in the first 3 months of this year alone. Some weeks, attacks are reported every day. Some attacks never get reported. Despite the chaos, Gambo Maman Gesau, another leading northern human rights activist, says the girls will not be forgotten.
Let them release the pure children. Poor children, let them release them. If they are not going to release them, we women in the Nigeria, we are going to gather ourselves and march.
Besides air support and resources, female activists in Maiduguri called on Boko Haram militants to negotiate with the government, promising the militants motherly support towards rehabilitating them when the need arises. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
United Nations mission in South Sudan says four people were wounded Thursday when gunmen attacked barges bringing supplies to a UN base. This is the second time this month UN operations in South Sudan have been targeted following a mob attack on a UN base in the town of Bor April 18th. UN mission says Thursday's attack took place as four barges steamed east on the Nile River carrying food and fuel to the UN base in Upper Nile State, where thousands of civilians have taken refuge from the violence. Meantime, the outgoing head of the Red Cross delegation in South Sudan is expressing surprise at how quickly conditions in the country are deteriorating. In an interview with VOA, the official warns the humanitarian crisis will become worse as the rainy season takes hold in a couple of weeks. Lisa Schlein reports now from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
Milker Mabek has just left his post as mission chief of the International Committee of the Red Cross in South Sudan, which he assumed in March 2012. At that time, he tells VOA, no one could have predicted the speed, geographical breadth, and ferocity of the crisis that erupted a little more than 4 months ago.
The country is not even 3 years old, and when I arrived 2 years ago, there was so much hope and joy and hopes for the future. It's been very, very sad to see these hopes destroyed in the last couple of months. You see the fear among people of a return to the old days of extended conflict and hardship.
Mabek says it is hard to predict the future, but the situation does not look optimistic. He says fighting between government and rebel forces will likely subside when the rainy season arrives next month, but the rains will pose other extremely difficult problems. He says more than 1 million people will remain displaced inside and outside the country, and reaching them with desperately needed aid will be a monumental challenge.
These people need food, they need shelter, they need clean water, and they need to be able to return to their homes at some point to start working the land again and to start producing food. The planting season has already been severely disrupted by this crisis. We're extremely concerned about the nutritional situation in South Sudan. Now, if this continues, it's likely to further deteriorate.
The United Nations reports more than 3.7 million people in South Sudan are going hungry. It warns 50,000 severely malnourished children could die by the end of the year if they do not get immediate treatment. Mabek says ICRC mobile surgical teams are deployed in areas affected by fighting and have treated more than 1,200 patients. He says the agency has provided basic needs for almost 200,000 displaced people.
We continue, of course, working on the issues of compliance with humanitarian law. This remains one of our main concerns, and we keep on a dialogue with both parties to the conflict and remind them of their obligations to abide by these very fundamental principles.
The Red Cross message that civilians must not be targeted does not appear to be getting through to the warring parties. The United Nations mission in South Sudan has accused rebels of killing more than 200 civilians last week after seizing the town of Bentiu. A rebel spokesman denied the charge. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
And we have one last item before we say goodbye. Several of the world's biggest technology companies are donating millions of dollars to fund security improvements in open source programs like OpenSSL after the software's Heartbleed glitch sent the computer industry into a panic recently. The nonprofit Linux Foundation announced the plan on Thursday. The technology group funding the improvements include Amazon, Cisco Systems, Facebook, Google, IBM, and seven other companies. The Heartbleed bug is in a vulnerable version of OpenSSL that potentially exposes millions of passwords, as well as credit card numbers and other sensitive bits of information, to theft. It was discovered earlier this month. Days after its discovery, the director of Homeland Security's National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center said there was not only reported attacks from the bug, but he said it is still possible that malicious actors could exploit unpatched systems. And it is time to say goodbye. Thank you, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. A reminder, latest world news is coming your way shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineers, Zubair El-Tayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On April 25th, 404 BC, Spartan armies defeated the Athenians, ending the Peloponnesian War. In 1599, Oliver Cromwell, leader of the English Revolution, was born. Cromwell, whose forces defeated those of King Charles I, took the title Lord Protector. He conquered Scotland and Ireland, expanded the English Empire, introduced electoral reform, and encouraged some religious toleration. Soon after his death, the English monarchy was restored. On this day in 1607, a Dutch fleet surprised a Spanish flotilla anchored at the Bay of Gibraltar. The Spanish warships, which were threatening Dutch trade in Asia, were destroyed. In 1859, construction began on the 163-kilometer-long Suez Canal that connects the Mediterranean and Red Seas. It took 10 years to complete. In 1898, the United States formally declared war on Spain. The U.S. victory in the Spanish-American War effectively ended the Spanish Empire. Spain ceded Puerto Rico, Cuba, Guam, and the Philippines to the United States. In 1908, American radio and television journalist Edward R. Murrow was born. Murrow is best remembered as a radio reporter giving on-the-scenes coverage during World War II. In 1915, the landings of Allied troops began at Gallipoli in Turkey. It was a bid to open a new front in the First World War and knock the Ottoman Empire out of the conflict. The effort failed and brought high casualties. On this day in 1945, Russian and American troops met along Germany's Elbe River, cutting the retreating German army in half. 2 weeks later, Germany surrendered in World War II. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 25th, we observe World Malaria Day to highlight the global effort to effectively control this terrible, yet largely preventable and treatable illness. Malaria is caused by a parasite called Plasmodium, which is transmitted through the bite of an infected female mosquito. Once it enters the body, the parasite multiplies in the liver and then infects red blood cells, causing fever, severe headache, and other symptoms. In some cases, the disease can progress to coma and eventually death. About half of the world's population, nearly 3.4 billion people, is at risk for malaria, primarily those living in developing countries. In 2012, 207 million people became infected with the disease, and 627,000 of them died, 482,000 of whom were children. Most of these deaths could have been prevented. Still, the news is good, and the situation is improving. According to the World Health Organization's 2013 World Malaria Report, global efforts against malaria have saved some 3.3 million lives since 2000 and reduced malaria mortality rates by 49% in Africa and 45% globally. The news is even better for children. The rate of malaria mortality among kids under the age of 5 is down 51%. In 2012, for the first time, fewer than 500,000 children died of malaria. Yet more needs to be done. To help fund the fight against malaria, President Barack Obama announced last December that the United States will provide $1 for every $2 contributed by the rest of the world to the Global Fund to fight HIV, TB, and malaria, up to $5 billion by 2016. "We're knocking on the door of doing what many 15 years ago deemed impossible," wrote Secretary of State John Kerry shortly after the release of the World Health Organization's report. "We can beat malaria, one of the most intransigent diseases on the planet, by bringing together governments, business leaders, philanthropists, donor agencies, and citizens in malaria-endemic countries to end deaths from this preventable and treatable disease. We're making tremendous, unparalleled progress."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.